Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, the writer-director of the new film Callback, The Unmaking of Bloodstain, Mr. Eric Wolfson, and the composer of the new film Captain Abu Rad, Mr. Austin Wintry. Wolfson and Wintry, coming up next on Movie Geeks United. Welcome to Movie Geeks United tonight. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us. Just a quick programming note right off the top of the bat. Those of you that are tuning in this evening to hear our Godfather Trilogy tribute, that show has been postponed until Sunday, this Sunday, September 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific. We wanted to give you the best possible show, live up to the standards that we've set for our previous tribute shows, and we felt that the Sunday date would allow us to do just that for that particular show. Meanwhile, tonight, we have writer-director Eric Wolfson and composer Austin Wintry. These two gentlemen came on our show last Wednesday, and because of long, drawn-out technical difficulties, we decided to re-premiere their interviews this evening. And speaking of technical difficulties, Blog Talk Radio has been riddled with them lately, because just yesterday we were part of the press junket for the new film The Lucky Ones, starring Tim Robbins, Rachel McAdams, and Michael Pena, and we're honored to be welcomed by Neil Berger until he called in and the phone lines weren't working on the switchboard. So we're in the process of rescheduling that show. And in future shows, we have in October, we're welcoming director James Gunn. We're also welcoming the director of a new documentary called Larry Flint, The Right to be Left Alone. And we have a lot more exciting prospects for October as well. In November, early November, we're going to welcome actors Robert Davi and Chaz Palminteri to these shows. So we're booking some great, phenomenal talent. I hope everyone out there can join us for those shows. If we're having any difficulty, if the sound is off or anything, if anyone from the chat room can let us know as the show progresses, we're going to start this evening by playing our interview with composer Austin Wintry. He is a versatile and phenomenal film composer. And this is out of all the film composer interviews that we've had, and we've had quite a few from Howard Shore to Mark Isham, and many, many others. This was a very entertaining trip down memory lane, investigating a lot of the great scores for films, and also really in-depth about what goes into creating a proper film score. So I hope you enjoy this one, and I'll see you on the other side. Austin Wintry ignited his musical motor behind a piano at the age of 10, and since then, his concert works have been performed throughout the U.S. and Europe. They've accompanied video games like PlayStation 3's Flow and have graced well over a dozen films, from intense psychological horror that he composed for the film Grace to the deeply felt sounds he created for the irresistible fable Captain Abu Rad. And speaking of Captain Abu Rad, here is a little taste of his score for that film. Thank you. a gorgeous movie and a beautiful, beautiful score. Please welcome to the show film composer Mr. Austin Wintory. Mr. Wintory, hello.
Hello, sir.
How are you? I'm so sorry about the confusion there, but we're thankful to have you on the show tonight. Thanks so much.
No, I'm good, and it's quite all right either way. It wouldn't be anything without technical problems.
That's right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. I wouldn't know what to do with myself unless I had to deal with them. Tell me about your musical background. You started, as I said, I believe on the piano when you were 10. Did you come from a musical family? Did they push you in that direction?
No, certainly not really a musical family. I mean, my grandmother was a violinist and pianist, but I didn't have a whole lot of contact with her while I was growing up. And so my father had inherited a certain amount of her musicality, and that's about it. My mother and my sister, for their many other attributes, are essentially tone deaf. And so I started figuring out some things by ear on the piano that we had lying around that no one ever used. And so they hooked me up with a piano teacher. And the weird thing is, up till that point in my life, I never really listened to music of any kind. It's like, you know, people would say, you know, what kind of bands do you like? And I would say, you know, I really don't know. And they're like, okay, you into classical music? And I'd say, I know of this, you know, so-called classical music. But it wasn't a big part of my life, so that when I started piano lessons and my teacher said, so what do you want to learn? What kind of, because he was a jazz cat and, you know, total, you know, cool jazz improviser type guy. And mm-hmm. But he said, you know, what do you want to learn? And I said, well, I don't honestly really know what's out there to learn. And so he said, well, I'm going to play you my favorite music. And so he brought me three LPs, and they were all Jerry Goldsmith scores. One was Patton, the other was Papillon, and the third was A Patch of Blue. And these are all, you know, Goldsmith scores from the late 60s, early 70s. And so from virtually my first piano lesson, I was like, got to start scoring movies. That's the mission.
So you were unlike a lot of composers that we've spoken to on the show in that you knew from the beginning that movie composition was your goal.
Exactly, yeah. I guess so. I really just was so blown away. I mean, of course, as a kid, growing up when I did, you know, seeing movies like Star Wars and Indiana Jones and all these, you know, big sort of John Williams scores, I loved those soundtracks and I mm-hmm. owned them, but I loved them as part of my love for the movie. I did not really separate it as music. But so even before this, though, there was that sort of seed, I guess, that was planted. But, yeah, it was this very first piano teacher of mine, a guy named Barry O'Leary, who sort of looked like Santa Claus the other 11 months of the year. You know, he wore big Hawaiian shirts and had a straw hat and, you know, totally not your typical childhood piano teacher.
Wow.
And he's the one who completely steered me onto this path. So.
Oh, that's terrific. You talk about Goldsmith, and, you know, he's, no one can argue he's the gold standard. But
yeah.
What other kinds of scores and composers' works have influenced you over the years and that you've been particularly taken by?
Well, I mean, I've got Goldsmith is always my number one. I mean, I think, you know, just about every single soundtrack that's ever been released of his, and then bootlegs of just about all the rest. It's, you know, hundreds of discs of just his.
Oh, yeah.
So virtually anything that I've ever been inspired by is going to come from there. But my number two, if I'm going to rank them like that, is more often than not actually Elliot Goldenthal, who's quite a different composer from Goldsmith.
Yeah, he is.
But is for me, you know, I studied in New York at NYU for a few years, and one of my teachers had been an orchestrator for him, and also both of them had studied under John Corigliano, and so I kind of absorbed some of that through osmosis and had been sort of obsessive about Goldenthal ever since. So between those two, I usually find anything I'm looking for. But, of course, I mean, there's hundreds of amazing composers. I mean, Gabriel Yared is one of those who I've known about forever, but in the last couple of years have had this sort of personal resurgence of interest in. And
I have been looking for a score of his for the past few months, and I don't even know if it was – I'm sure it was issued, but it's nowhere. You can't – the Clean and Sober score, which was an early score he did 20 years ago – So you can tell we're all big movie score geeks on the show. So.
Yeah, right.
Good company then. If only the director of Albedrad were with us, Amin. He could probably put every one of us to shame. I've never met a director who knows more about film music than I do, much less more than anyone in the world.
Yeah, we spoke several months ago, over the summer, I believe, on the show,
then.
And we spent the first 15 minutes talking about movie scores.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you're absolutely right.
First meeting he and I ever had, he came over to my studio, and we had spoken on the phone for a few hours on our sort of a first actual contact with each other a few days before. And I got the sense that this guy really knows his stuff. And then he came over to my studio, and we ended up sort of accidentally playing what turns out to be his favorite game in the world, where I basically just, I have, you know, something like 20,000 MP3s of film music in my iTunes on my office computer. And I would just randomly just grab one, like literally out of these thousands and thousands of tracks, just grab one at random. And, you know, normally within 5 seconds, he'll say, okay, that's track 7 of James Horner's score to A Far Off Place, but you should really go to track 6, 35 seconds in, there's a killer French horn solo. And then you're just like, what the hell? He's like a robot. I mean, it's totally insane. I've never met anyone like him.
Oh, that's terrific. That's great. Well, now that we're on the subject of the film and your work with him, tell me how this project came about for you, Captain Albedrad.
Sure. Well, the film, Amin and I met when he was actually looking for a composer to score his thesis short while a student at AFI, and that's what drew me to him. You know, I had sort of made a conscious effort to not be scoring shorts anymore, much less student projects in favor of, you know, obviously feature films and video game projects and things like that, but I got this, you know, email that was sent out to, you know, presumably hundreds of composers that you could just tell this guy knew film music more than your average director. So I got in touch with him, and he wanted something that was sort of in the style of the Goldsmith Omen trilogy. And the film, if you've seen, you've seen Captain Albedrad, and this his thesis short, which was called Morning Latte, was probably as opposite as you can get from this film. It was a sort of dark comedy about if Satan ran a Starbucks, basically. And it was very bizarre and wacky, and so we had a lot of fun with the score, and it's incredibly gigantic and epic, and, you know, it's like people sitting around in a coffee shop, basically. And so while I was scoring that, he was in Jordan filming Captain Albedrad, so he came back, and we finished up the score to this, and then actually Gabriel Yared was supposed to score Albedrad. Amin had sent it off to him before he and I had ever met, and Yared loved the film and loved the script, and then Amin sent him a real rough cut of it, and he said, you know, I absolutely want to do this. And so Amin and I, of course, had become really close friends, and he said, you know, he says, I want you to score my film, but at the same time, Gabriel Yared is telling me, you know, he'll do it and he'll help us out in terms of, you know, we can't afford him, and that's not going to, you know, be a problem. And he really just wants to work on this project. And he said, you know, but I don't want to turn a back on our friendship. What should I do? And I said, well, don't be stupid. If Gabriel Yared wants to score your film, have Gabriel Yared score your film.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, the executive producer was adamant, saying, you know, that he would be the biggest name associated with the project. He's an Academy Award-winning composer. You know, we would be it would add cachet to the project. We would be foolish to say no. And I fully agreed, because at this point, I knew Amin and I had a friendship that was going to transcend just one film. And so I said, you know, do what's best for your movie, because ultimately that's better for everybody, because it'll help the film. And but as luck would have it, Yared ended up with a schedule conflict on what would turn out to be his final collaboration with Anthony Minghella. And so, because, you know, obviously Minghella passed away quite tragically and far too young several months later, and so Yared was able to complete that project with him, and that opened the door for me to do the film. So, you know, kind of worked out all across the board.
And so when do you start in this project, and in general, when did you start on this project? What did you start percolating some ideas from the raw footage, or did you wait until it was assembled? When did you start doing that
I saw their second to last cut before it was fully picture locked, which they referred to as their Sundance cut. And so all told, the score was completely, from the very first pencil scratching I put to paper to delivering a hard drive with all the mixes of the score was within a 3-week period. So it was quick, and obviously it would have been nice to have, a month or two to work on. But as it, what has been the trend with me that has been, I guess, just lucky, is that I tend to have a creative process on a film that's sort of like a gas in a closed jar, so that it'll expand to the size of the container. So if I'm given a year to score a film, at the end of that year, it will feel like I could never have done this with any less time. I needed a year to score it. But if I'm told I need 3 weeks, I guess I just subconsciously kind of recalibrate my thinking so that 3 weeks is exactly what I need. Because truthfully, as fast as I had to write it, I don't know that I would want to change anything about it.
Yeah.
Which is probably the first score I ever wrote that I felt that way. Because usually a month down the road, I look back at it and I think, oh, it's just awful. And I still feel quite good about this. So anyway, to answer your question, yeah, I started with a pretty much finalized cut, and just started going at it, right away, and just dove straight in.
So you're looking at this cut, and it's a fable of sorts. It's about a man whose hope and passion for life is restored by these relationships that he forges. Tell me what your thinking process is before those opening notes come to you. What do you try to understand about this piece before you can flesh it out on the piano?
Well, I tend to perhaps over intellectualize a film before I start writing. I think it through. I watch it, over and over and over and over, 4 or 5 times a day before I start composing. So if I have 3 weeks, that first probably 5 or 6 days, I won't write a note, because I'll just be spending that time trying to let ideas, let the movie tell me what to do. Because otherwise, it's going to be kind of knee-jerk, generic-sounding stuff. That's what I've observed of my own behavior. When I've written things fast in the past, and then I look back on it, I say, oh, man, I could have done a hell of a lot better than that.
Right.
And so I spend a certain requisite sort of R&D phase at the beginning, and this was no different. So again, like you keep referring to it as a fable, and that's exactly how Amin thought of it as well. And because the big debate with this film, which has been sort of an ongoing debate ever since, was, do we score it with Arabic instruments or an orchestra or a combination? And Amin said from the beginning, it'd be nice to have sprinklings of Arabic flavor, but it really needs to be an orchestral score, because what we're trying to send are universal messages that are not pegging any one particular culture. At this point, the use of orchestra is technically, yes, a Western gesture, but virtually the whole world just kind of reads it as a default. It's a more of a universal statement. And so that was a huge conclusion for us to come to be able to move forward with, because, and as evidenced by, when we went to Dubai after the premiere, the very first question that went up in the audience was, well, why wasn't it Arabic instruments? Why was it not oud and kanun and tablas, and instead why was it oboe and cello and French horn? Our answer was just this. This is what this film needed. We were telling a fairy tale set in a modern and very real world. It had fairy tale sort of sensibilities and values, but yet the emotional impact came from its very sort of believable realism. And orchestra seemed to be the only way to really capture that. So figuring out those kinds of details was the first step. And then I always end up sort of flow charting out the whole film and saying, okay, where do I want to go? How do I want to start? And what kind of arc can I build into it? So it's just a matter of breaking it down from there, I guess.
Yeah, when I spoke to Amin, that was one of the first things that I told him, was that I was particularly taken by the music. And he spoke to wanting the theme to pull your heartstrings, that he wanted that to be one of the major functions of the music. And it's a very emotional score. And I think absolutely the orchestra was the perfect way to go with that.
Well, yeah, thank you.
Yeah. What kind of collaborator is he? Is he very and do you appreciate a profound dialogue while you're doing it? Do you prefer that the director be an intricate part of the process?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, every director is different, and some are easier to work with than others, but I always encourage the maximum amount of collaboration because I know that the more non-musical sort of filmic director input that I get, the more original I feel I'm going to write. If I am just writing as if I'm the director, mm-hmm. I'll be following all of my instincts alone, and it's, from my perspective, it's sort of like I know those instincts. I'm familiar with that. But my goal in being a composer and as an artist is to try to push past that and, you know, dig deeper and find a way to, you know, in a sense, reinvent the wheel.
Yeah.
And so with a director, especially a really great one, they will offer their own feedback, which is frequently totally not musical at all. You know, they'll say, I think this scene just needs more oomph, you know, and that's the note. And,
yeah.
You know, there's 100 million interpretations of what that means, but I respond to more than if you get, I've worked with directors, for example, who actually are quite well-trained musicians, and they'll say, now you have an E-flat chord and these, you know, violins on a tremolo here, and I think that maybe if they were down a half step, and they give you all these musical notes, and I find that that's actually much more difficult to deal with than someone who's just responding to the drama of the film, because that's all that the music is geared towards. You know, I try to put the artistry and the writing on my own, but the core function has to be serving the film. And so when they offer their director-like feedback, that's always going to create the best results with me.
Have you had to deal with a, because I know composers feel differently about this topic, with a temp score or a director that wants a particular sound that mirrors another popular score?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, that's impossible to avoid. And again, certain directors are better at dealing with that than others. For example, not to get off topic of Captain Brad, but I just finished this film, Grace. They're actually dubbing it this week.
Yeah.
And it's a really just wicked and amazing horror film by this guy named Paul Solit. And in that case, there was no temp at all. And when the executive producer said, we need to see this film and, you know, sign off on it at this point, the director actually came to me and said, will you make a temp score? So this was a highly unusual situation for me where I actually went through 2 or 3 weeks before I started scoring the film and created the entire temp myself using some music that I had written, and I used, there was quite a lot of Basic Instinct that made it into the temp, which is one of the all-time great scores in my opinion.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
And I created this temp, and then I watched the film and was like, oh man, this is great. This works really well. So then I basically took 2 weeks off so that I could try to forget it as much as possible, and then so I could score it basically in a radically different direction, which we ended up doing. And if you listened, you would never hear a relationship to the temp. But that's also a huge credit to the director because, you know, he basically, I told him, I said, look, I'm going to show you this once, and then can we just agree to never watch it with the temp again? And he said, sure, because he was extremely open to anything. I mean, as long as he felt like the movie's best interests were in mind, he was willing to roll with just about any crazy idea that we had.
Yeah.
And so the score ended up being, you know, solo cello, solo violin, and then this crazy ensemble that we recorded at Abbey Road of all bass and contrabass clarinets, and it was lots of custom samples of things that I recorded myself, like babies screaming and all kinds of weird stuff. And so it turned out completely different than the temp. And again, that was a total credit to the director. In the case of Abu Red, there was a temp there that was I can't remember. Some of it was from a Thomas Newman score that I actually didn't know, and it was not the sort of American Beauty Thomas Newman. It was more like the Little Women Thomas Newman.
Right.
But it was neither of those scores. I can't remember now which one it was. And when it comes to temp, I remember reading once in an interview Jerry Goldsmith saying that he always actually found temp quite useful because it gave you a sort of point of discussion to talk with the director and say, okay, what's working about it and what's not? Because sometimes they fall in love with the temp, but they rarely fall in love with every single nuanced detail of it. It's always some factor, like the temp moves really quickly, and that's all that they're responding to. It's all about tempo. So if you can write anything you want, and as long as it's at that same tempo, then they'll love it. And it's usually something like that. So it's more a matter of figuring out what's good about the temp. And in that sense, it's enormously helpful because it can also be a way of saying what's not working, and you can get a lot of bad ideas out of the way if the temp's really just, you know, kind of maybe helping, but not really. You can really learn a lot about what the score needs that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember once James Newton Howard saying that he doesn't ever mind temp because he doesn't have much difficulty completely blowing the temp out of the water and just vastly, creating something which is so superior that they don't even remember the temp. So I've always tried to approach it with that level of the thinking, you know, where it's like, sure, put it in there, bring it on. And,
I like
it.
Sometimes
it's harder. Yeah, exactly. And then they put in, Basic Instinct, and you're like, fuck.
Is there a dream genre for you that you haven't been able to tackle yet? I know you've done very impressive work, as you've said, with Grace, with the thriller horror kind of genre, and that has to be very freeing. But is there any specific kind of genre that you're looking to tackle in the future?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, I've done 16 or 17 features now, and they're all different, and that's for me. Earlier this year I did a sort of vampire action horror movie that was, I felt like it was straight out of the 80s, and so that that was one thing. And then there's this sort of Grace is that kind of psychological horror, and Abu Ra'ed is that totally straight character drama, and sort of the purest sense. And I just started this week a fantastic, I mean, unbelievably great comedy that's sort of a comedy in the Alexander Payne sense of a comedy, where you laugh a lot throughout the film, and then by the end you're feeling pretty moved. It's an extremely smart film. It's called Knuckle Draggers, and so I have high hopes for that film. And so it's I don't know that I have a dream genre. I mean, obviously your big huge epic is always fun, but but each film presents a challenge that. That is totally unique, even if it's a genre that you've done over and over. I mean, for example, at the beginning you mentioned Flow, which is this PS3 game that I did, and that was radically unlike anything that I've ever even attempted. I mean, not only is the music down to the smallest detail completely interactive, but there's no melody at any point in the whole game, and there's something like 4 hours of music. Yeah. And so it's all just very carefully done sort of textures, but I've never liked, on websites and forums and stuff, they frequently refer to it as new age music, which I've always felt was not the right description. I mean, I don't, honestly, people can call it whatever they want, but, that was all just sort of textures and color. And so, I'm just grateful for any excuse to write music. I don't really have any agenda as to what genre.
Yeah, I've been curious about something concerning film composing, and our next guest is on the line. I appreciate his patience, and in just a few moments we'll pick up for that interview. But I was wondering if you could shed some light on this for me. Are there trends in film music? You mentioned the 80s, the film that you felt came right out of the 80s. Do you notice trends in film music?
Well, yeah, everybody loves Hans Zimmer. I mean, there's no overstating the influence of Hans on the film music horizon today. You know, easily half of all the major Hollywood films go through what is now called Remote Control Studios, formerly Media Ventures. And, you know, every year, some composer's career is born there, and, you know, some sustain, some don't. I mean, the greatest, I mean, to my mind, the next Jerry Goldsmith, hands down, my favorite composer who every new album I go get is John Powell. And he was born of that environment. And I mean, you turn on, like, you know, CNN or Fox News or something like that, and it's all this Hans Zimmer style music that they have as their lead into the show. And I mean, he created this sound which has percolated into every slightest, most crevice of our society. And so that's the trend right now. And his style of music, which I love, has nothing to do with my style of music. And I mean, as someone who, you know, looks to, you know, if you just look at Ellie Goldenthal or Jerry Goldsmith, those are several worlds apart from Hans. And so, and that's not a bad thing. It's just, you know, his thing's not my thing. But that can make it difficult to work when a director comes to me. You know, like, I had this one come to me, and I love him to death, and he kept saying, you know, give me Transformers. You know that Jablonski guy? I love that shit. And, you know, and I, you know, so I have to, you know, find a way of writing my version of that, which feels like me, but is not, you know, but is also not going to get me fired for, you know, completely just ignoring that direction. Because, I mean, if someone says Hans Zimmer, I know exactly what they mean. I mean, it's a very clear cut, very well-defined sound. And so that is the big trend. I mean, that if you look at least half of all the major scores coming out, they're either just steeped in that or influenced to some great degree. Likely the score was produced by Hans himself. I mean, if you just look at, like, major scores like this Babylon AD that just came out by Atli Arvason, that's a Hans score, or Iron Man by Ramin, that's a Hans score, you know what I mean? And these guys are doing great work, and I'm not at all slamming what they do. It's just, that is the trend. That is the popular thing. I mean, it's just like in the early 80s, in the windfall of Star Wars, everything, you know, a bunch of composers' career who could write in that big, majestic John Williams style were born, like Basil Poledouris and Bruce Broughton and all those.
I was
thinking
the same thing. Wow.
Yeah, it's the exact same, you know, it's just the sort of the cycle of life of film music. And at some point, you know, someone in the next, well, let's see here. So Hans is, I think he just turned 51 a couple of weeks ago. So 40 years from now, something else will happen. He's actually great. He's an extremely giving guy. I mean, if you just look how many careers have been made, if only John Powell and Harry Gregson-Williams as the two examples. I mean, this he's created quite something unique. And I mean, it's basically a return to the studio system of old, because so many prominent producers and directors and whatnot will go to him and say, I know you're too busy to score my film, but who do you recommend? And so then he'll say, well, you know, Trevor Morris, I think, is probably ready, and so Trevor gets his big break. I mean, like, as a great example, Jim Dooley, who's a dear friend of mine and a hell of a composer, just won the Emmy for Pushing Daisies, like 4 or 5 days ago, and that's a career that was completely, you know, Jim started working for Hans 8 years ago, fresh out of USC, and was his assistant on Gladiator as his first gig, and you know, he's just won an Emmy, so. You know, it's become a tried and true tradition. He's kind of the new Alfred Newman in that sense.
Yeah. And amazing talent. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great thing. So that's a very long-winded way of saying that is haunted.
Thank you so much, Mr. Wintery, for joining us tonight. And please, when we have more time, I'm so sorry that we had the glitches tonight, but when we have more time, come back to us and let's talk more film scores. We just love talking about them.
Yeah, please do. Please come back.
Yeah, well, you got it, and no worries on the on the.
Wait, I have one quick question, though.
Sure.
If you can answer this. And if you can, I completely understand. Do you have a favorite Jerry Goldsmith score?
Oh man, that is a tough one. It varies on the day of the week and the lunar eclipse cycles and all that kind of thing.
I hear you.
My two favorites that I go back to again and again and have probably logged the most hours listening to are The Wind and the Lion.
One of mine.
Yeah, there's one particular cue in The Wind of the Lion which is to me the benchmark of film music.
I agree with you.
And then the other one, which probably is my favorite, is Under Fire.
That's a good one.
That's such a just freakishly original piece of writing. Kenny Hall, who was Jerry Goldsmith. Go ahead.
No, I can't find my favorite one on CD anywhere. And that's The Boys in Brazil.
You know, I've got that CD in my car right now.
Do you have? Is that an import?
I have the original Japanese film music masters one that's, you know, supposedly worth hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, I bet. That's one of my favorite scores. I love
I've got that,
that
one, but I've, the one that's in my car is actually a bootleg, which is like 40 minutes longer of the score. So email me your address, and I'll send you a copy, and you can relish in the Viennese waltz madness of it.
I can't wait. Thank you.
Look at that, Jerry. You got hooked up tonight.
I asked the right question at the right time.
It's killer. I mean, it's literally in my car.
That's awesome. You have beautiful taste. That's all I'm going to say. Just exquisite taste.
Well, you know, come on. I mean, these guys, you stand on the shoulders of giants. I mean, my one sort of regret is that I never met Goldsmith in my life before. Obviously, he passed away a few years ago, and the closest I came was I was going to go see him in concert, and it was, I think, probably the last concert he was going to give, and he was in pretty bad health, so he canceled it, and I wasn't able to go, but I've been sort of vicariously living anyway because I've become good friends with his longtime music editor, a guy named Kenny Hall.
Right.
And Kenny and I go and grab lunch every few weeks, and I mine him for crazy stories, and just it's unbelievable the stories that this guy has. So,
I'm sorry, Mr. Wintery. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. You've made Jerry's night.
Yeah, you made my night. I'm glad someone agrees with me about the two seminal films of my youth, you know?
There you go. And you've made our night.
Knowing Colt, he's all pissed at us now, though. He never seemed to be one for the spotlight, so he's rolling over in his grave or his urn, as the case may be, and scorning us.
Yeah, that's probably true. Thank you so much, Mr. Wintery, for joining us tonight. We look forward to speaking to you in the future.
No, thank you. Have a great night.
You too. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye now.
All right, bye.
Okay, that was Austin Wintry, the composer of Captain Abu Rad, and an upcoming psychological thriller called Grace. And you can purchase one of his film scores on our homepage there. Just click on the icon of the front of the CD, and it'll take you directly to his Amazon page where you can purchase many of his works. Coming up next, we have an interview with writer-director Eric Wolfson. His new film called Callback, The Unmaking of Bloodstain is kind of a Hollywood dark satire, and it opens up in L.A. this weekend, and it'll open wider as the weeks pass. This is a great interview, and actually surprising and very funny at the end of the interview. So keep tuned in to the conclusion of the interview, and you'll see exactly what I mean. I think I threw a major curveball at the end of this one. Here's writer-director Eric Wolfson. Eric Wolfson is a highly accomplished, award-winning playwright and filmmaker whose new film, Callback, The Unmaking of Bloodstain, opens on Friday, September 26 in L.A. Callback is an observant and biting dark comedy about the chaos and undoing of a Hollywood film production The film's exceptional writing and direction, along with its roster of fantastically funny performances, has won over countless festival audiences from Australia to Beverly Hills. Please welcome to the show the editor, producer, writer, and director of Callback, Mr. Eric Wolfson. Mr. Wolfson, are you with us?
I'm with you. But, I mean, after that introduction, I think I can go. I don't know what I have.
No, stay. Stay. Please stay.
Please stay. We finally got you here.
Okay. You guys do it. Hey, congratulations, Jerry, on that Boys from Brazil thing. That's a score.
Literally. Thank you. I mean, got to tell you, it's just like one of those movies, you know, you can't find, you know, I always look online and stuff, and I know you can get it overseas, but you can't get it here. And I think I've bugged, you know, everyone about it for 25 years now.
One of my favorites, too, so I might have to bug you for that copy.
Okay, yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. You
we'll just spread the love.
As soon as I get it, I definitely will share it.
There you go.
So talk to me about, and thank you so much for your patience tonight.
No problem. I wasn't sure at first what was going on, but I figured it out. So
yeah, we're never sure what's going on either on the show.
You started
your obsession with theater and film at the age of nine. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. Actually, I started out as an actor, and thank God realized my mistake and moved to behind the camera. But for many years, started out as an actor and had a strange series of coincidences that kind of thrust me into being in front of the camera as a child. Basically, I had injured myself in a water slide accident, which you don't hear too many of those, but I was coming down a water slide on my knees a little too fast and smashed my two front teeth into the side of the water slide. They turned to pulp in my mouth. And I had to get these huge braces put on my two front teeth, very prominent. And my next-door neighbor just happened to be a working actress and was kind of directing and helping to cast a project that just so happened to have a child coming out of a dentist's office and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I said, sure, and they didn't need the prosthetics, so I got the part. And I sort of fell in love with it and pursued acting and theater for most of my childhood until I went into college and kind of started to segue into writing and directing, but spent a year in San Francisco after college working as a professional actor, full-time theater actor. And that sort of started my kind of that's where a lot of inspiration from Callback comes from that period, as well as from my writing partner Michael's trials and travails as an actor. And so, you know, it seemed a fitting movie to make as my first feature because it was in some ways sort of my sort of farewell to being in front of the camera. And So that's sort of the genesis.
Well, tell me about San Francisco, because
beautiful city. There's the Golden Gate
Bridge. I've understood from previous guests that it's very conducive to creativity and creative people just merge there. You get that sense when you're there. Was it like
yeah,
that for
I think
you?
Certainly. You know, growing up there, I felt that a lot. I remember as a child going to see the Pickle Family Circus, who were performing all over the place, the Mime Troupe. All of that was very important and influential as a child. ACT's great theater scene up there. And then when I came back after college, found it to be less so. They were going through the kind of the dot communist takeover, and things got it got very hard to be there as an artist, which was one of the things that helped push me down to L.A. And now going back, I think things have changed again, and I see a lot more of that. Mayor Willie Brown at the time kind of literally kicked out all the homeless people out of San Francisco. I think he put them all on a bus and said,
Willie Brown did that?
Yeah, which, you know, is not a good thing, actually. I mean,
no,
a city
surprised.
With no homeless is...
That contradicts his, you know, his public persona, though, that we see all over the country, you know, and I'm surprised by that. Okay, wow.
Yeah, the put it this way, there was no underbelly left in San Francisco by the time I left, and now it's back, which is good. I mean, you got to have your underbelly.
Yeah, exactly.
So who were your inspirations during this time? I mean, you started out as an actor and you moved into filmmaking. Were there actors and directors that you looked up to more than others?
Absolutely. You know, I would say especially, and you can see it all over Callback, it's kind of clear. I got really influenced lately by sort of the Latin American and Mexican New Wave cinema. So guys like Iñárritu and you know, these people who are doing different things with storytelling and deciding that, you know, you didn't have to tell a story from, you know, front to back, that there was time, film time and audiences had gotten to a point of being able to really, you could take them places that you didn't used to be able to take them to. And for me, that makes a lot of sense. And you'll see in Callback, I mean, I would say there's influences from Kurosawa in terms of we tell the story from different perspectives. To Iñárritu, certainly what he did with Amores Perros and with 21 Grams, and the way that you know, it's just not a straight line that progresses throughout. And I really appreciate that. You know, and then I think we drew kind of heavily on classics as well. I think there's some Kubrick. There's definitely a little homage to Chinatown. There's a lot of classic kind of cinema moments that I sort of drew upon to tell the story, and directors and artists that have inspired me.
Well, you just mentioned Kurosawa's name, and that was actually going to be a question that I asked of you, because if I'm not mistaken, you double majored or your minor in college was it Japanese culture, or
who are you guys? The FBI? What is this? you guys are thorough,
well,
man.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what we do, you know.
Yeah,
right. That's
right. And then Jamie's like, you know, the professional here. He's like, he knows everything about everyone.
I'm super impressed. Yeah, it's true. My minor was Japanese studies, and I actually took a year off between my sophomore and junior year of college, which was at UC Santa Cruz, and went to spend a year in Asia and 6 months in Japan and another 6 months traveling through Southeast Asia. And I had just been very much in love with Japanese culture since I started martial arts when I was a child and continued to do martial arts. And so, I was very inspired by Japanese culture, including Japanese film. And Kurosawa was definitely a huge influence on me. And, it's something that I just think American audiences are used to certain things, you know, conventional American audiences, and when I say that, I mean, like, you know, people who are going to see the blockbuster films are used to certain things that independent film-going audiences can do. In other words, a vocabulary exists for people who are seeing independent films that might not exist for people who are going to see the kind of mainstream stuff that's out there. And and a lot of that, I think, has to do with foreign films and watching stuff that doesn't come from America.
Yeah, and we've talked about this on the show before, and we seem to have as a culture, we've lost that. And you know, your film, and I saw it just recently, and it's fantastic. I mean, your film kind of speaks to this in some ways. Do you find that this is becoming more and more prevalent, that filmmakers and people that aspire to be in the industry don't know that history that you cultivated as a young man?
Well, that's sort of what I'm saying, is that I think the good ones do, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that the people who treat it as a craft, and maybe that's a discipline I learned in A, martial arts, but also B, in working in the theater, is that you treat it as a craft rather than just a job or a way to make money. You know, I think of myself as a storyteller, you know.
Right.
Right now I'm doing a documentary. I would love to go back and direct theater. And for me, it's not so much necessarily the medium as much as it is telling the story. I mean, I love film and I'm obsessed with film, but I think just being able to tell a story in a way that's fun and exciting and engaging and, you know, a story that people can learn from, I think that's what it's all about. And
yeah,
to do that, I think you need to learn all the tools that you have at your disposal.
And
you
tell me,
that
tell me
really
the difference.
Honing your craft.
Yeah, tell me the difference, because you have experience in both, in telling a story for the stage and a story for film.
Well, the beautiful thing about the stage is that you get instant gratification, you know. You know what's working instantly and what's not. And that's a very helpful process for anyone who's made a film and who's spent months, you know, a month or two shooting it and, you know, years developing it, and then another year or months and more months and months in the editing room. You know that oftentimes you'll shoot something, think it's working great. You can have people cracking up on set. And then it's time to show it to an audience, and the audience will look at it and go, okay. And it's too bad you can't have more of that kind of instant gratification and understanding in the way that we have in theater, because it would be very helpful and people could save a lot of money. But, I mean, an example of that being that I know when I made my – when we did our first cut of Callback, my editing partner and I, we were so proud. And I think the thing was 2 hours plus. And it's a comedy, so 2 hours for comedy, not a good thing. But we were so blinded by it. We had worked so hard on all of it that we looked at it and we were just like, I think this is going to be one of the first movies that doesn't have deleted scenes in it. I mean, there's nothing we need to cut out here.
Right.
And we showed it to an audience, and I remember the comment I got over and over again was, you have a lot of great stuff in your film, a lot of great stuff. Like, it was just too much, you know, and it was kind of the kiss of death. So we ended up, you know, pairing out all of these scenes. In fact, one scene that never made it into the final product that's on the editing room floor was one of my favorite scenes in the film. But it was kind of a non sequitur and a tangent, and we had to get rid of it to service the rest of the film. And so that's a way in which I think the two genres are very different.
Yeah, it is amazing how the chemistry of the piece changes when you show it to an impartial audience. Tell me a little bit about on your rise in the industry, some of the observations that you've made that made their way into the film. What did you want to explore? What situations have you been through that you wanted to explore in this film?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think certainly with Michael, my writing partner on the film, who plays Carl, the thug who can't seem to get a break as a thug or as an actor, he channeled a lot of his frustration as an actor into the movie and into the writing of the script. He wrote the first draft of the film, and then we worked on it together after that. And I think a lot of those experiences are shared experiences that every actor can relate to. And you have in the film what I consider to be sort of the three main types of working actors in the industry, and those actors are one, the guy who basically, or gal who gets off of a bus and 2 weeks later lands in some production, you know, for God knows what reason, without hardly trying. You have the guy who gets it through nepotism, knows somebody in the business. In our case, it's Carl's character, and his uncle is a producer who puts him in the movie. And lastly, the guy who has been busting his butt forever and finally gets a great role and is suddenly an overnight, you know, he's a success and a discovery, even though he's been working forever and trying to make a dent. And so I think, you know, one of the things we were just talking about and conveying and working in terms of ideas with in the movie is just how difficult and desperate Hollywood can be, and how people's dreams are sort of broken, and how damaged people can get, and sort of the lengths that people will go to make their dreams come true. And I mean, if you think about it, there's two sides to Hollywood, right? There's the entourage side, which is the, you know, the one percentile, or the top, you know, 4 or 5 percentile of people who are actually out there really working at what it is they want to be doing and making a living and having the fun stories and the crazy hot tub parties. And then there's the bulk of the people working in Hollywood who are just struggling to make ends meet, who are passionate about what they want to do, and really, you know, putting their butts on the line to try and make it in a very callous industry. And I think, you know, having come out of being an actor, and I have nothing but respect for actors because of the difficulty of that lifestyle and that choice. It's so brave, you know. I mean, it's just nonstop rejection and pain. And to come to have the bravery and the fortitude and tenacity to make a go at that, I think, is what we're trying to, you know, sort of illustrate and celebrate in the movie.
I would think with this kind of film, you know, it's a dark comedy. Is establishing the tone one of the most difficult and important aspects of a film like this?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think our tone shifts, and that was intentional. So we set up a few different tones And in fact, if you know, we have three main characters who, and then there's this sort of character who comes in as the catalyst, you know, basically in the end of the second act. I was trying to establish was a few different tones because I described these individual characters. It was really each one of them had kind of their own thing going on, and we actually, if you really study the film, went into different detail for each of them. So, you know, Johnny's piece, Johnny Moreno, who plays Peter, his whole piece was kind of supposed to be he was doing it a whole different thing than what was happening with Jeff Parise, who played Tony. Tony had basically a musical, was what we were trying to create out of his life. And you can see that reflected in the colors and so forth, so on. And Carl's piece was a film noir. And so they all kind of had their own tone, and that was part of what we were trying to establish, which I think in the beginning either hooks you or it turns you off. So, yeah, I mean, I think some people, they think, well, the tone, I'm not quite sure what it is. And then if you hold on for a little while, and once the characters kind of come together and those worlds collide, it really pays off. But yeah, I mean, I think it can be really challenging. And if you don't establish that right away, or if people don't get it right away, I think it can definitely be a turnoff to people.
Yeah. And you've played this film is played, as we mentioned, in festivals all over. Do you find that it plays differently in California in the midst of that film industry than it does in other areas?
Well, you know what I've found, surprisingly, is that people in Hollywood aren't that interested in seeing it, which is interesting. You know, certainly in film festivals, I expected we would play all of the big Hollywood film festivals, and
right.
We didn't. And I heard over and over again that people are not that interested in movies about movies.
That's kind of true.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
What were you saying?
That's kind of true, sadly, that they're not.
Which is interesting, but there are a lot of films and things that point to the contrary.
You're
television.
Absolutely right, but I hear this now and then. I do.
Yeah, it's a weird phenomenon. I mean, if you look at the popularity of Entourage, if you look at the popularity of Project Greenlight when it was on, the television set or the TV set is a movie that was just out about that.
That's
Living
a
in
great
Oblivion.
Movie. Great
yeah,
film.
It's a great movie. Living in Oblivion, unscripted. You know, I mean, there's a huge number of these
right.
things, and a lot of them do really well and have big lives, but for some reason it's like Hollywood is nervous about lampooning itself or
it
opening
is.
It up, itself up to criticism, I guess.
It is very hard for them to look in the mirror.
Yeah,
it's so ripe for criticism.
Yeah.
Right,
I have a question for you, Eric. I do have a question for you. I love Entourage. I love it a lot. I think it's an awesome show. But don't you feel, now since you are in the industry, you've done this, don't you feel that the show makes it look so easy?
Absolutely.
I mean, just to a point, even my brother who had tried to break into the business a long time ago said he loves the show, but he goes, Jerry, it's just not like that. It's just never like that.
Well, but then again, you've got the Johnny Drama character who kind of shows that it isn't that like that. You know,
right,
he's
now he's on top as it is right now. I mean,
right,
back on
right.
top.
But, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that's exactly what Callback sort of says, is that, you know, it's not that easy.
Right. No, that's
this
good.
Is,
no, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad
yeah.
to hear that.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're crazy about movies on the show, and I'm not sure how to make this segue. Let me turn to another passion in my life, which is masturbation.
Oh, boy. I knew it was
wow,
coming.
Wow, James,
no pun intended.
You said on the air, oh, the show is, folks,
yeah.
it's historic tonight.
You are working on a documentary I read on the history and anthropology of masturbation.
That is correct.
Tell me anything about this.
How? Sticky is the name of the movie. Sticky, a documentary on masturbation.
Don't
knock my hobbies.
Yeah, I won't. In fact, you know, it's funny, but the Callback led me to Sticky, so go figure. I was at the Sedona Film Festival with Callback, and I was interviewed by a gentleman who, by the name of Nick Tanna, who was working at the festival, kind of doing just that, interviewing filmmakers. And we started talking, and he told me, you know, I have an idea for a film. I'm like, really, what is it? And you hear that all the time, you know, as a filmmaker, you hear that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I have an idea for a film. And you know, I always listen, I'm always curious, but more often than not, you're like, okay, well, good luck with that. And Nick says to me, I have an idea for a film. I said, what is it? He says, it's a documentary on masturbation. And I said, I thought about it for a second, and I thought, has there anything like that been done? And I searched my database, which, like you guys, I'm sure is, you know, pretty decent. And I said, I really don't think anything has. I said, sign me up. What can I do? And at that time, it was just a concept. He didn't have anyone else involved. So I went to work as the producer and editor of the piece. He's directing. And as we speak, I'm taking a break from frantic editing for the Sundance late deadline, which is next Monday.
Mm.
And, yeah, it's a pretty awesome documentary about masturbation. We've interviewed 65 people, I believe, at this point, including Jocelyn Elders, the former Surgeon General fired by Clinton for condoning masturbation.
Right.
Who else?
I want to be interviewed for this.
Well, that's another funny thing about this documentary. Every person I talk to about this documentary says I can't possibly be making this without them in it. Like, they all...
Well,
it's so funny.
It's the one thing
we
I
all,
can do.
Yeah, exactly. We all feel this pride and ownership in our ability to masturbate.
Right. I mean, come on. This is...
Yeah, we're all trying to come together, as the director likes to say.
Yeah.
So you're submitting this into Sundance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Correct.
Well, that's exciting. I just saw that was something you're working on. I couldn't let you go without asking you about it.
No, absolutely. I appreciate it. In fact,
StickyTheMovie.com. StickyTheMovie.com is the website. Okay.
Yes.
So your film Callback, it opens Friday, September 26th in L.A. It opens in the Sunset 5, the theater there?
The Lemley Sunset 5,
Lemley Sunset 5, yeah.
Yes, that's a great venue.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Wolfson, thank you so much for your patience tonight and for being with us and being such a great guest. And we welcome you back on anytime you'd like in the future.
We'll have us back on for Sticky, guys.
Right.
We sure will.
As soon as possible.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much, Eric.
Soon.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, babe. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Okay, that was writer-director Eric Wolfson. A spirited discussion on his new film, Callback, The Unmaking of Bloodstain and Masturbation. Where can you find anything better than that? It's all right here on Movie Geeks United. Tune in to us on Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific, where we will have a special 90-minute tribute to the Godfather trilogy. Part of that show will be, obviously, an in-depth analysis of the three films between myself, Jerry, and Chris, the original Movie Geeks, together again. And we will also play exclusive clips of deleted scenes from the Godfather films, as well as give you guys a comprehensive review of the new Coppola restoration of the three films that are now available on DVD starting yesterday. They became available. Now, the Coppola restoration is actually Steven Spielberg, when his company DreamWorks was bought by Paramount, Coppola called Spielberg and said, I have a favor to ask now that you're working at Paramount. Could you see if they could pull out the original print of The Godfather 1 and 2 and remaster it, because those prints are in major disrepair? And Spielberg took it upon himself to do that as the first order of business at his new home in Paramount, which he's no longer with Paramount now. That's a different story. But they went, they found the best elements from prints across the country, and they went frame by frame. It was a two-year process, and now we have pristine transfers of both Godfather films. And if you're used to seeing them on video or on TV, these are dark movies, and they look very dull on some of these formats. I won't say that I'll say that the darkness is just luminous in these new transfers. The golden nostalgic quality of it is intact. It wasn't remastered to look brand spanking new, because these are antique-looking films. And so it stayed true to the spirit of these films, this transfer, which is fantastic. So we will talk in depth about the three films, and we encourage everyone's phone calls and tell us what you think of the three films. It's obviously been a big part of every movie fan's life for the past 35 years. Thanks for listening tonight. We will be back Sunday, and then we'll be back on Wednesday, October 1st. We'll welcome the director of a new documentary on Larry Flint called Larry Flint, The Right to be Left Alone. And whatever you feel about Larry Flint, and I definitely have my opinions on him, it is shocking, some of the revelations in this documentary and how influential Larry Flint has been in a number of mediums. So that's going to be a great conversation. We'll also be welcoming the composer of the new Leonardo DiCaprio and Russell Crowe film, Body of Lies, next week. And hopefully we're very close to confirming Toby Jones, who played Truman Capote in the film Infamous. He plays Karl Rove in the upcoming Oliver Stone film W, and Swifty Lazar in the upcoming Ron Howard film Frost Nixon. We've verified actors Robert Davi and Chaz Palminteri for the first week of November. And just a great lineup of guests coming up, so be sure to stay tuned. Be back with you Sunday. Thanks, everyone, for joining us tonight. See you later.
Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.